Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join me for a few minutes today as we talk about some classic and not so classic cardboard. And this week we talk about a not so classic that has become a classic in my life recently. Another bargain bin beauty. And I liken my coming back to this particular set to a situation that I'm sure we've all been in at some point in our lives. If not, I would be surprised. But chances are there is somebody you know that has been through this scenario. Let me lay it out for you this way. So think back to your high school days. Now, I know most of the people who listen to this podcast, you're in your 40s, maybe early 50s. So we're going back 25, 30, maybe 35 years ago, depending how old you are. And think back to your high school days. Think back to the one girl in class who wasn't the most popular, wasn't necessarily the most attractive, seemed to be a good person. You didn't really get to know her real well because, again, it's high school. It's cliquish. Even though you were a baseball card collecting nerd, you still, you know, drooled over the hot girls that were in class. So there's that one girl in class who is a good person, is intelligent, has some interests that may cross paths with your interest, but again, from afar. You know, she's not the most attractive. She's not the, athlete of the year in the school. She is not the most likely to succeed in the school yearbook. She's not that girl. You've got your hots for the more attractive ones, for the more popular ones, for the ones that, maybe you caught a glimpse of her in a bikini while on spring break. And, you know, you're going after those. You're not going after the quiet ones who are really good, but, they're just not popular. Why should I get excited over this girl when, you know, this attractive blonde over here? Granted, all the guys in the school want to go out with her, but I'm going to stand in line and wait for my chance. So fast forward to present day, or close to present day, you know, maybe the last few years, and maybe you're at a class reunion, or perhaps you're at your favorite local restaurant, or, you know, there's a store that you frequent, not a grocery store, but, you know, maybe it's a bookstore or something like that, and you run into the girl who you didn't really pay much attention to. You didn't dislike her, but you didn't really pay that much attention to. And you kind of shunned her because you were making googly eyes with Little Miss Attractive over here at the other side of the classroom. And when you meet the girl that you kind of ignored for many, many years, you get to talking. And maybe you bring up an old story or two. Hey, how's it going? Great to see you. So glad you're doing well. Hey, let's connect on Facebook or whatever. And after you have that conversation, it dawns on you. You're like, you know, she's actually really cool and really nice and still all these years very attractive and, you know, a fun person to run into here today. I never expected I'd see her again. Geez, it's been 25 years or whatever. And you come away with it thinking back to those days in high school where you go, gee, what if I had, you know, like hung around with her more or asked her out and, you know, wasn't in the line of 200 potential suitors for the really attractive, popular girl. I could have, you know, maybe done something with this rather bookish but friendly and attractive in more ways than I thought, girl who was sitting quietly over the corner here. That has probably happened to you. And you know, if it didn't, then I'm kind of surprised, like I said, because I think we all have those interactions in our life, those missed opportunities where it is 20, 30 years later, where you go, gee, whatever happened to so and so? You know, she was actually kind of cooler than I thought, or more attractive, or nicer, or a better person than I thought. And you know, not that you regret it and want to go back in time and try to do it all over again, but you kind of sit there and go, boy, if I knew then what I know now, I probably would have given her a little more than the time of the day. And you know, at this point, I'm also hoping, as I'm reminiscing about these interactions, and it's happened to me a couple times in my life. I'm hoping my wife's not listening because I don't want to get her suspicions raised. But you know, this is very similar to my flirtation, dare I call it, with 88 Tops. Yes, 88 Tops has become that girl in my life where I reluctantly collected it, didn't really admire it, shunned it, pushed it to the back of the cardboard box collection. Very quickly dumped it in my mass dumping of junk wax cards many, many years ago. But have come around recently and kind of went, wow, this isn't so bad. And it is 88 Tops that we focus on this week, as it is a bargain bin beauty. Picked it up recently at a card show. I mentioned this actually in the last program, how at a recent card show, a buyer that or a seller, I should say, that I typically buy from, had stacks and stacks of junk wax era boxes. This guy's, clearly cleaning out one corner of his spare bedroom. Lots of 87 Tops, lots of 86 Tops. Got some 86 Tops racks. He was selling them pretty cheap. So, 86 Tops, one of those sets I'm trying to hand build. So I figured, well, I might as well just grab a handful of these and add them to the collection. But he had about 10 boxes, cello boxes of 88 Tops, and they were just stacked up. And I think he was selling them for $8 or $9 a piece. And because we've struck up a pretty good rapport over the last year or so that I've been going to the show, and because I will gladly take junk wax off his hands if it's something that I need. And again, that's the gift that keeps on giving. If you ever want to help a card dealer buy some junk wax off his hands, he'll probably throw in an extra box for no extra cost. They just want it out of their house. So, I looked at the stack of 88 Tops and I said, I'm gonna circle around the rest of the show here, but I'll be back. I'm gonna get one of these. And he says, oh, you can have one for $5. I said, great. I'll be back and I'll get one of these for $5. So it is a true bargain bin beauty. I didn't even have to start the negotiation. He threw in the $5, and I threw the $5 in cash back to him later on in the program. And I've brought the box home here, opened up a couple of the packs on our video break, which you can get a link to on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, or if you go to YouTube, just type in Wax Ecstatic 88 Top Cello Pack Break. Not too many great stars in there. A couple of notable names. I would say probably the biggest name is Wade Boggs, an all-star card of him. But we also had Tim Wallach, one of the more underrated third baseman slash infielders of the 1980s, of course, playing in Montreal for many of those years. That was part of the reason why he was underrated. Also, Andre Dawson, Dave Stewart, who we're going to talk about later on in the program. So, some semi-star cards, nothing that breaks the bank. Of course, in 1988, there wasn't a whole lot that did, not just in Tops, but all the other sets that came out that year. But it was fun to revisit, the girl that I kind of looked away from for many years, 88 Tops. And we'll talk more about the set, how I came around to appreciate the set a lot more. And this is all something that's happened just in the last couple of years. And how it is a very affordable and fun set to collect. And it is something that, because there is so much of it out there, if you're looking just for an easy set to put together, a rather cheap set to put together, maybe a project for you and your kids to work on. I know summer's wrapping up for a lot of people. Here in Florida, school's already started again. So for those of you who live up north, maybe it's a late summer project. You can run out to your local card shop and, you know, get that box of 88 tops or a couple of boxes. It's not going to cost you much, 10 or 15 bucks. And put together a simple set, a very nice, clean set that does have some star power, but does have some faults to it. Although, much like the bookish girl with the curly hair who kind of sat off to the side in classroom, it's not her fault. There were a lot of circumstances that limited the popularity of 88 Tops, not only back in 1988, but still now to this day. But we're going to give it a second look. Now, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday, so our next podcast will be coming your way on Friday, August the 30th. It will drop at noon Eastern via Audio Boom and all of our various channels that grab that RSS feed and send it out. Most notably, iTunes, also iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Spotify, and Google Play. Like I said, there are many other platforms that grab it, so however you grab your Wax Ecstatic, however you grab your junk wax, make sure that you tune in on Friday, August the 30th. And also, many of those platforms have our full archive as well. We have over 130 episodes, so feel free to listen into any of the past episodes of this program that we put together from the past three or so years. And get nostalgic, you know, 90s nostalgic. 90s nostalgia is big these days, and we all yearn for the days of the past as we deal with the political nonsense of today, the economic hardships of today, raising a family and you know, trying to stay employed, you know, all that fun stuff. We deal with that crap every day. So it's always nice to just reach back to something from our childhood, and we're able to do that with a complete breakdown of not only every set that came out in the 80s and 90s, but as you go through our archive, we can go all the way back to the late 1940s. We've been able to, very fortunately, over the years through my personal collection or through purchases made for this program to discuss, we've got every major card release that's been out since the late 1940s. And we certainly hope that you enjoy listening to those past episodes. Now, if you enjoy Wax Ecstatic, keep the program going strong by making a cash donation via our PayPal donation bin, if you will, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. I appreciate all donations that have come in. We've had several listeners who have been multiple donors. Thank you very much. If you're still on the fence or going, well, you know, I just don't really want to, just keep in mind, I'm not asking for a ton of money. It could even be $5 if that's what you want to give. Or if you want to give more, that's great too. But just keep in mind that 100% of the money that comes in goes right back into the program. And ultimately, big picture, it goes back into the hobby. How does your money work? Well, first of all, it keeps the program running on Audio Boom. There is an annual fee to do that. So to keep our shows coming out and also keep the archive alive and well and keep the RSS feed loaded with programs that get spread out through all the other platforms, it does cost money. So a lot of your donation goes to that. But also any money that comes in goes to the purchase of the packs and the cards that we talk about on this show. So when I go to that card show, and I've got another one this weekend, actually, summer's just flown right by. I swear I was just at the show. But anyways, we got another show this weekend. As I go up and down the aisles and look at all the tables and look at cards to purchase, it's not necessarily for my own personal collection, although I do buy those, but the money that you donate goes to the purchase of packs and boxes and individual cards, some unique cards that we pick up along the way. It is all made possible through your donations. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, one final note, any excess material. So all the 88 Tops cards that don't go into the collation of my set, and there will be some extra cards, probably about 400, 500 of them. They get packed up into boxes and we send them out to one of two nonprofit organizations. The next package will be going out to Commons for Kids as they collect commons from present day and past, and they will box them up and make sure that they get out to kids in hospitals and you know, kids just looking to get into the hobby, not just getting new cards but older cards as well. And then we also send care packages every few months to Kidoorty Cards, and Kidoorty Cards is a great service that for a small monthly fee, you sign up your child to receive a monthly package of cards that is put together for his or her favorite team. And it's not just baseball. They do other sports also, NASCAR, you name it. Kidoorty Cards has been able to collect a lot of cards that have been donated over the years and put together these care packages, these fun little gift bags for your kids. And both Kidoorty Cards and Common for Kids do a great thing. First of all, helping kids who may not be able to afford cards or may not be able to go out and track down all these cards for their favorite teams or their favorite players. Well, you can do that for them, but also keeps kids interested in the hobby. In a day and age where everything is digital, you have to pull your kids away from the video games and from your iPad and from the cell phone. It's nice to pull them away from that, give them a stack of cards, and to sit there and look through the different players, the different teams, if they're older cards, the different uniforms, the stats that are on the backs of cards. A lot of good things being done, again, by Commons for Kids and Kidoorty Cards. So again, any donation you make, it goes to the maintenance of the show, it goes to the purchase of the product, and any excess product that we have goes right back into the community with those two groups. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. We appreciate every donation that comes through the door, and we do implore you to please donate a few bucks here or there, because if you don't, I still have the 89 Bowman Rack Pack. It is still in the closet, lurking, ready to be featured in a show because our donations have dried up. So, again, using the Oral Roberts technique of hanging guilt over your head, I will do that too. You know, if we don't get donations, I will open up the 89 Bowman Rack Pack, and you will have to deal with the consequences. Not a big fan of 89 Bowman. Of course, Andy from Sport Card Back joining us on the program last week. Thank you so much, Andy, once again. And it was a fun look at the backs of cards, which is the part of the card you normally don't look at. But it's something that I do challenge you, if you haven't done it yet, the next time you buy a pack of cards or you get a lot of cards, or you just want to go through your own collection, turn the box around, pull out a stack of cards, and read the backs first. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised and entertained by what you find on the backs of some of these baseball cards. You'll also be entertained by what you see on Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, which is open 24/7. And we encourage you to pass along the handle to your friends who collect or maybe don't collect anymore, but did back in the day. And, you know, they're looking for some childhood memories. Tell them to check out Wax and Gum Stains. Follow us on Twitter. We will not only send you the links to shows and video links and stuff like that on there, but it's an open forum. And feel free to tag us in your conversations about the hobby, or if you have any questions or comments about any of the sets or the players, or anything else that we talk about on the program, or if you have suggestions for topics on the show, hey, we've got an open ear. So go ahead and make them. Send your questions, your comments, your suggestions at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, a great photograph that was posted there a few days ago. I believe it was a promotional photograph, but regardless of what it was used for, it is a beauty. Taken from just outside the storefront to the Renata Galasso baseball card shop in New York City. This would have been probably the early to mid 80s. Standing outside that card shop, one Henry Hank Aaron and one Dwight Dr. K. Gooden. Now, this was a picture looking at Doc Gooden. He's probably, you know, very early in his career. So I'm guessing probably 1984. I think by then he had secured a spot in the Mets rotation. And by then, you know, having Dwight Gooden hang around with Hank Aaron for a promotional picture, it wasn't quite Nolan Ryan and Todd Van Poppel for a Beckett Baseball Card Monthly cover. So, yeah, this was bona fide Dwight Gooden. You knew he had the goods. And, of course, Hank Aaron at that time, recently inducted into the Hall of Fame. So, you know that if Hank feels that Dwight is qualified, then, you know, this has to be at least a couple years into Dwight's career. But here's Gooden and Aaron outside of the storefront of Renata Galasso's card shop in New York City. And that picture has gotten a lot of buzz from our listeners. And we've also picked up a few listeners because of it. So thank you for sharing that. But I commented, imagine if you're inside the store and, you know, Renata Galasso, we talked about her several episodes ago when we took a look at the TCMA Galasso set from 1977. And imagine going in that store and you're picking up your brand new hand collated by Renata Galasso, your 84 Tops card set, and your special Renata Galasso subset. That's how those sets got out there. You know, she made them in conjunction with TCMA, and that was the bonus buy. If you ordered the factory set from Renata, she'd throw in that set on the side. So you're in the store. You've got your 84 Tops set in one hand. You've got a smaller box with the Galasso cards in the other. And you walk out, and there on the street corner, getting their picture taken, is Dwight Gooden and Hank Aaron. Now, again, in 1984, you didn't really know what you would get out of Dwight Gooden. You knew he was good, but still a phenom pitcher. I mean, standing next to the home run king, you'd probably drop your cards, to be honest with you. But just imagine that scene. I'm somebody who doesn't get starstruck that often. You know, I'm around athletes all the time, so it's kind of part of the business. You know, you just really don't get awed by, you know, professional athletes when you're doing what I do. But I would be in awe if I just walk out of a card shop and there's Hank Aaron and Dwight Gooden. Even to this day, even though Hank Aaron, you know, he's up there. And, you know, he's been dealing with a lot of health issues the last several years. And, of course, Dwight Gooden, I mean, he's had, what, a couple of arrests just within the last month. And Dwight Gooden is a guy, whether you were a Mets fan or a Dwight Gooden fan, you're really hoping he can pull it together and figure it out and get the help he needs. Of course, considering he's been battling drug addiction and all sorts of nastiness for over 30 years now, who knows if he's going to get that? You hope he does, but he's a guy that you pull for, and especially because of his upbringing, you know, being raised in a really bad part of town here in Tampa, in the Seminole Heights area, and, you know, basically finding his life on the baseball diamond, and of course being blessed with this God-given talent of throwing just an incredible fastball at such a young age. And, you know, turning it into not only a major league career, he was a World Series champion and a guy who, you know, had he stayed healthy and stayed on the straight and narrow, you know, you're probably talking Hall of Fame candidacy. But he's been struggling, and he has been for many, many, many years now. So you hope that he can pull it all together. But whether it was 1984 or 35 years later, just imagine coming out of your card shop and there's Hank Aaron and Dwight Gooden. Holy cow. So that photograph has gotten a lot of buzz on Wax and Gum Stains, not only because you've got some well wishes for Dwight Gooden, but also some stories about the Renata Galasso store and what happened to Renata Galasso. So there's a whole lot there. You could just follow our timeline again at Wax and Gum Stains. So please comment, share that handle with your collecting friends everywhere, and join in the conversation as Wax and Gum Stains is open 24/7. All right, 88 Tops. You know, I use the analogy of 88 Tops being the girl in high school, or maybe it wasn't even high school. It could be junior high, elementary school, whatever. You know, the girl who was just kind of off in the corner, wasn't very popular, maybe wasn't all that good looking, you know, was maybe a little bit of a nerd, and kind of kept to herself, didn't really get involved in a lot of the classroom or school activities. Maybe she lived in your neighborhood, but you didn't play with her because she wasn't the more popular kid in town. And all these years later, you finally, you know, meet that girl once and again, and you go, wow, she turned out okay. And you go, gee, maybe I should have, you know, paid more attention. You know, maybe I should have given her a little more respect when I was younger. That is 88 Tops. And for those of you who have listened to this podcast for a long time, thank you. But you've heard my story about 88 Tops. And, you know, I even brought it up briefly in the last show, and I don't want to bore you with the details. So let me give you the skinny version here. And that is that I started collecting in 1989, didn't have a whole lot of money to my name. After all, I was, what, 12, 13 years old. So, you know, I'm still not quite to the level of being able to charge $20 a lawn to mow. I was getting there. But, you know, basically, I would only get $3 or $4 a week through allowance and doing other things around the house for my parents. So I didn't have a whole lot of money. So when I was fortunate enough to go to a card shop or a card show, even if I saved up my money, I would only be showing up with maybe $12, $15, you know, not a whole lot. So I couldn't afford the Upper Deck cards that were coming out at the time. I couldn't afford, you know, certainly when Stadium Club first came out, I, you know, still wasn't there. Like, I wasn't able to pool my money into larger sums until like 92 or 93. So for the first 2 or 3 years that I'm collecting, I'm basically just getting the basic stuff, you know, a wax pack here, a rack pack there. I'm buying packs of cards from the grocery stores and the drug stores. So when I went to a card store, often I would end up buying like an 88 Tops pack or 89 Score or 90 Donruss because, you know, I got more bang for my buck. Like for $3, I could buy 5 packs of these cards. Where had I been a little more shrewd with my money, for $3, I could have, if I saved my $3 over the time span of a couple of weeks, I could have brought in $6 and, you know, picked up, you know, a pack of 84 Tops or 81 Donruss or whatever. So, you know, occasionally I did that, but more often than not, just because I wanted to get my hands on cards, I would buy the cheapest packs I could get and I would have more cards and, you know, that was my experience. Not that there was anything wrong with it. I, you know, hey, I got to enjoy baseball cards, with my spare money. So over the years, as I did get more money and I could get better cards, I would shy away from 88 Tops. And, you know, 88 Tops wasn't the worst, but I'm sure like many collectors, much like you, your vast quantities of 88 Donruss or 90 Donruss or 89 Score or 91 Fleer, you know, the cards that were in your collection, you pushed them to the back of the collection. They didn't mean as much. Maybe you didn't carefully sort them by team or by card number, or you know, picked out the dupes so that you had your hand collated set getting prepared. No, you may have actually looked at a box of 88 Donruss and went, you know, I don't need these. And, you know, you just donated them or you threw them out. You know, maybe you did that. So everyone has that experience where there's a certain set of cards where you collected them a lot at first and then you just go, and you just kind of push them aside. And for many, many, many years, 88 Tops was the bane of my collecting existence. It's just like, why did I buy so many of those stinking cards? And they were easy to purge. My big old monster box, remember that? That's what started the podcast. You know, when I was getting rid of cards and keeping cards, you know, the big old monster box was the 81 through 87 cards that I liked. And basically the demarcation of cards that I was totally fine with getting rid of started with 1988. And part of the reason is not only because I was tired of hauling around 20, 25,000 cards from Junk Wax Era, and I was thankfully able to find a shop that just took them off my hands for $1 a box. Where things turned around a couple years ago, as you know, I'm hand collating 87 tops, and then I start with 89, and then I go, oh, I like the 90 set, let me do that. I went on eBay and I bought a lot of vending boxes. And I love vending boxes. In fact, that may be, you know, I don't have any more vending boxes in my collection, but that may be one of the topics of an upcoming show. I'll track down a vending box somewhere and we'll open it and we'll pick a few random cards and talk about players. But, you know, I got a lot of vending boxes, one box each from 87, 88, 89, 90, and 91 tops. So the first box I open up, naturally 87. One, because I was finishing up putting a set together. Two, it's 87 tops. Of course you got to dive into the 87 tops. And of course, you know, there's a Barry Bonds rookie floating around in there. So yeah, you dive right into the 87 tops. Then I think 91 tops was next. And I believe 89 was right after that, because 89 tops was the first pack of cards I bought, and that's what got my collecting going. And, you know, 90 tops, I didn't waste too much time on. In fact, I started hand collating a set from that vending box. The 88 box, though, just kind of sat in my closet for, I don't want to say a year, I don't think it was that long, but it was a good 6 months. I was in no rush to open up the 88 tops box and see what was in there. I just had no desire whatsoever. So finally, one day, I don't remember what I was doing. I don't remember why I decided to do this. But I went, well, I guess I should open that 88 vending box. So I open it up. And as I'm thumbing through this box, I don't know if I just happened to have a good box. You know, there weren't a lot of duplicates. The cards were in very good condition. And I mean, you know, when I say very good, I mean mint. And that's always dicey with vending boxes, because Topps would jam pack 500 cards into a rather flimsy 500 card count box. So, you know, the cards would bow a little bit. The first and last 10 or 15 cards typically got damaged just in handling. That wasn't the case with this box. I think there were only three or four cards that were damaged from being at the end of the box. And as I'm going card through card, the colors stand out more. The photography stands out more. The orange and black backs stand out more. And I spent at least an hour just looking through this entire box of cards. And it hit me then. So again, this would have been maybe a year or two ago. It hit me then. I'm like, this is a really good set. So that's the moment, much like when you ran into that slightly unpopular, unattractive girl from 25, 30 years ago. You run into her at your grocery store or whatever, and she actually is doing just fine and is very attractive and very nice and sweet and everything you thought she was, but you basically ignored that she actually was. That was 88 tops. And it was that moment I'm like, this is actually a really good set. And I've been crapping on it for years. And in fact, if you go back to the original podcast that I did on 88 tops, Glenn Davis, then with the Houston Astros, was the featured card. I basically said, much like Glenn Davis's, Orioles career, sorry, Baltimore fans, I had to bring that up. But, much like Glenn Davis's days in Baltimore, the 88 Tops leaves a lot to be desired. And basically, I'm like, oh, it's good, but it's not great. And it's just, meh. But, again, through going through this vending box, I realize this is a hell of a set. This is actually really, really good. And there are some factors, much like you were distracted by the attractive girl and you didn't look at the bookish nerdy one. The same thing happened with 88 Tops. For one, 88 Tops is not 87 Tops. It's not its fault. Okay. 87 Tops, of course, legendary, a classic design. You got the Bonds rookie card in there. You had Bo Jackson. You had Mark McGwire. You had Jose Canseco. You had a lot of early career cards for Roger Clemens and Darryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden and, legends in the game like Pete Rose and Nolan Ryan and Michael Jack Schmidt and the late, great Harry Callis voice. So you had so much going for 87 Tops. So when 88 comes out, it's not quite where 87 was. It was very much like when Howard Stern left CBS Radio and CBS needed to put in fill-in host or replacement host, and David Lee Roth was named the replacement for Howard Stern on the East Coast. David Lee Roth, no matter how good of a talk show host he could have been, was set up for failure. And that's what, because, nobody is Howard Stern. As good as anybody who follows in the footsteps of Howard Stern, nobody is Howard Stern. So likewise, nothing is 87 Tops. And you can dress up current cards to look like 87 Tops. Nothing's like it. It's got its own niche in baseball card history. So 88 Tops had that going against it. It just was not going to be able to live up to the 87 Tops design and the star power. I mentioned all the big rookies. Really in 88 Tops, it's Tom Glavine. That's the big name that comes out of there. So, there's not a whole lot that really grabs you with 88 Tops, which is rather unfortunate because again, it's circumstantial. There's nothing that set could have done. Basically having an older brother, if you will, that was much more popular than that particular set. So it didn't have the classic design, it didn't have the popularity, it didn't have the big rookie class for 88 Tops. But also, as we know now, hindsight being 2020, 1988 was, in my opinion, the year where the junk wax era began. You had Tops, you had Fleer, you had Donruss, then Score comes in. And even though Score put out a really good baseball card in 1988, all of a sudden you have four card companies. And you still had Sportsflix hanging on then, barely. So technically five. And then come 1989, you've got Upper Deck entering the fray, changing the game. You've got Bowman entering the fray. And then, within a couple of years, you've got the premium sets coming up and everything explodes. So you had some problems back in 88 in terms of the set wasn't the 87 set. And you have problems years after where a lot of people just tired of the hobby and the saturation of all the various products and they shied away from that set. And other people are in my situation too, where you bought lots and lots of it as a kid. There wasn't a lot of cash value to it. So as you were looking to make more purchases that were of a higher value, or you were trying to sell cards, you couldn't sell 88 Tops cards. Nobody wanted them. You kind of looked at it with a very leery eye. You just kind of went, 88 Tops, so what? So, there were a lot of things working against 88 Tops then. But much like the bookish nerdy girl who was in your class that you see nowadays and you go, wow, she was actually pretty good. 88 Tops is one of those sets here. And thankfully, because so much of it was made and so few people like it, as I discussed before, if you wanted a quick, fun project with your kids or by yourself or with other collectors, It is very easy to get 88 tops. You can find it anywhere. You can find them on eBay relatively cheap, but if you go to a card show or you go to a card shop and you go, hey, I want to do you a favor. I want to take some 88 tops off your hands. You may, I'll be honest with you, you may find a dealer who just says, really? And then, you know, once you pick them up off the floor, then they'll go, I'll give you some 88 tops. Like, they don't even want any money. It's just, here's a couple of boxes, be gone. Then you can go. Now, if they do charge you, and they probably will, it'll probably be just like my friend at the card show. You'll probably get them for just $5, maybe a couple dollars more, but that's it. If you're paying more than $10 for any box of 88 tops, you're paying too much. So negotiate it down and be upfront and honest and go, hey, pal, I want to take this junk wax off your hands. Give it to me for $5. And they'll probably relent. But 792 cards. Yes, the Tom Glavin card's the big one there. But you do have a lot of star power, a lot of second-year cards or first tops cards, as we like to say. You know, Greg Maddux had his first or had his rookie card in the 87 tops traded set. Same thing with Fred McGriff. So you can get their true first tops cards in the 88 set. So you do have some star power there. You do have, you know, a lot of the veterans. I mentioned, you know, Nolan Ryan. Mike Schmidt, of course, was wrapping up his career at that point in time. If you like the dreaded manager card of Pete Rose, you can get that. So you still have, you know, a lot of legends who are still playing them. You had a lot of stars who were still playing then. And while from a cash value standpoint, they may not get you as much money as an 87 Topps Barry Bonds, still an 88 Topps Barry Bonds is not a shabby card to have. In fact, I can see it in my mind's eye. It's a, you know, great shot of Bonds at spring training. You'll see that the color pops from the cards a little bit. They utilized a little bit of the 3D technology of dropping the team name behind the player's body. So what Fleer started doing in 1987, Topps very quickly picked up in 1988. And I think, too, another appreciation for the 88 Topps set comes from the simplicity. And, you know, nothing wrong with today's cards. In fact, I like the Topps cards from the last 5 or 6 years. Still, you know, they're designed by computers and there's lots of cutting angles and, you know, big flashy logos and, of course, refractors and different colors and backgrounds and variations and you name it. There's something to be appreciated with the simplicity of 88 Topps. And when you take the 88 Topps set and you put it up against the other sets from 1988, being Fleer, Donruss, and Score, 88 Topps stands up very well against the competition. Extremely well, I'll say. Now, I've always had a soft spot for 88 Donruss. I think it gets way too much crap. And it's mostly because there's a gazillion, you know, copies of the set still out there. So there's not a lot of value to it. I've always been a champion of Score's premier set in 88. I always thought that there was a lot of color, a lot of innovation, a lot of great detail on the backs of the cards with the scouting reports. And of course, you know, Fleer, I've been a big fan of Fleer from the mid 80s, not their best effort in 88, but still a pretty good set. So amongst a middling collection of sets from 1988 that were released, Topps really stands strong against them. And you could argue that Topps had the best set, certainly in terms of design in 1988. Not necessarily in card selection because, you know, a couple other companies were able to scoop Topps on some rookies, especially Roberto Alomar. You know, he appeared in the 88 Donruss set. Also, Edgar Martinez in the 88 Fleer set. So Topps missed the boat on some of the young rookies at the time. But in terms of design, you know, 88 Topps is actually pretty decent. So I've come full circle. I'll say that. And that's the beauty of looking back at some of these, especially the junk wax era cards. Taking a look back at some of these cards, you get a second look at them and you go, you know, this is actually better than I remember it. this deserves a little more respect than it had gotten over previous years. And that is definitely the case of the 88 Tops. So I'm going to sound like Willie Nelson here. To all the girls I've loved before. Not quite that. You know, to the girls that you ignored because you were focused on the hot one over there. You know, this 88 Tops set is for you because you're very much the living embodiment of this particular baseball card set. Boy, if I used, you know, a romantic approach like that to some of these girls back then, I probably would have dated a lot more. And we would have collected baseball cards and comic books together. How lovely. But, you know, this is one of those sets that I've not only come full circle and have a better appreciation for, but I really recognize now how much I missed with this set. And I'm not going to shower myself in 88 Tops cards these days. I am hand collating the set, and with the cello box, I'm going to try to complete the set. But I do have much more of an appreciation for it now. It will not simply get shoved to the back of the box or, you know, go right to the donation bin. It will have a little more of an appreciation. I'll spend a little more time looking at them, reading the backs of the cards, and realizing that while 88 Tops was not the sexy 87 Tops, it was, however, a very good, well-balanced set that 35 years later, or 31 years later, see, I was too busy watching The Hot Girl and not paying attention in math class. 31 years later, much like the bookish nerdy girl on the other end of the classroom, stands rather strong these days. All right, let's take a look at four random cards from the two packs that I open. I'm going to start with Tracy Jones, and I start with Tracy Jones because I said this while I was opening the pack and I saw the card. I said, you know, here's Tracy Jones riding that train. If you're a Grateful Dead fan, you know the song I'm talking about, Riding That Train, High on Cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your step. All right, so Tracy Jones here featured with the Cincinnati Reds. This would be his last time with the Reds, as he would eventually move on to the Montreal Expos later, the Giants, the Tigers, and the Mariners. In fact, he was traded to the Mariners from the Tigers for Darnell Coles, who is a player that we're going to talk about a little later. His pro career wrapped up in 1991. However, featured in this 88 Tops card, showing off the statistics from his most productive season, appearing in 116 games in 1987 for the Reds, batting .290 and stealing 31 bases. He played at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, originally drafted by the Mets in 1982. Didn't sign, however, in the secondary phase of the amateur draft. He was selected first overall by the Reds. Would make his major league debut April 7th, 1986. He only had to make his debut against Steve Carlton, old lefty, the Hall of Famer, winding down his career with the Philadelphia Phillies at this point in his career. But he would eventually, in his first game, get his first major league hit. So even though Tracy Jones, you know, played, how many games did he play around? It doesn't say how many he had in his career. But anyways, even though he only played, what, 5-6 years in the big leagues and is not exactly a household name, you get your first big league hit off of Steve Carlton. Well, it's pretty good brag-worthy feat that you've done there. Now, after his playing days, he got into being a financial service planner. He is the owner of Tracy Jones Financial in Kentucky. He would also be a longtime co-host on sports radio with WLW in Cincinnati. He was a co-host with Marty Brenneman, with Brenneman and Jones on baseball. Also a co-host with Eddie Fingers of a popular radio show on WLW. And us radio nerds, we will totally get this. So he was a co-host with Fingers. Well, when he got let go from the station, when was this? A couple years ago, 2017. He was with Eddie Fingers for a while, gets laid off in 2017. And the day that he left the station, Rocky Boyman co-hosted the show with Eddie Fingers on Monday. Fingers co-hosted with Meat and Deb on Friday. So that just goes to show you the state of radio these days, where Tracy Jones gets let go from his co-host Fingers, who would later partner with Meat. It's kind of like Weenie in the Butt on Family Guy. So there's Tracy Jones, now a financial planner, longtime talk show host, and a guy who can brag that he got his first major league hit off of Steve Carlton. Speaking of Darnell Coles, I mentioned that Jones was traded for Coles later on. Darnell Coles is a guy, and I think we may have talked about him before, but I love his playing career. Listen to this. First with Seattle, later Detroit, Pittsburgh, Seattle, Detroit, San Francisco, Cincinnati, Toronto, St. Louis, went over to Japan for the Chunichi Dragons, then Colorado, then back to Japan with the Hanshin Tigers. 1983 to 1997. That, my friend, is quite the career. And then, as we'll discuss, he got into coaching. He was a four-sport letterman, three-time baseball MVP at Eisenhower High School in Rialto, California, drafted in the first round, sixth overall by the Seattle Mariners in the 1980 amateur draft. Now, he actually went right to the Mariners organization, turning down a baseball and football scholarship at UCLA. How about them apples? He would eventually make his way up to Seattle, like I said, starting in 1983. Hit a career-high 20 home runs for the Tigers in 1986. Had three home run games in his career, 1987 with Pittsburgh, which he's pictured here with in this 88 Topps card, and later with Toronto in 1994. Now, after his playing career, he was hired as a roving hitting instructor with the Washington Nationals in 2006, eventually worked his way up through the coaching ranks in the minors, and then became a hitting coach for several teams, first Detroit, 2014, spent four seasons with the Milwaukee Brewers, and is currently the hitting coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Now, there is also a connection, much like Tracy Jones to Darnell Coles. There is a connection with Darnell Coles and Dave Stewart. Now, I'm pretty certain I've talked about Dave Stewart before as well. That's what happens when you do 3 years and over 130 of these podcasts. There's bound to be some repetition, so I do apologize if you've heard any of this story. But Dave Stewart's just got such a fascinating story. Born and raised in Oakland, and his dad did not really care for sports, didn't think that his son or anybody could make a living as an athlete. And, you know, his dad was old school. His father, David, was a longshoreman. His mother, Natalie, worked at a cannery. So you've got blue collar, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. What do you mean you want to be a baseball player? You need to work in a factory. So his father did not really coach him at all in sports. And according to lore, his older brother taught him how to play baseball, and it worked out rather well for him, as Stewart would stand out not only in baseball, but in many other sports. First of all, in football, he was a linebacker and a tight end, actually received 30 college scholarships to play football, turned them all down. He was also a star forward on the basketball team, averaged 16 points per game, was an All-American in baseball, where he was originally a catcher, believe it or not, and he was eventually selected by the Dodgers in the 1975 draft, 16th round, and the Dodgers really liked his arm. And of course, at the time, they had some pretty good prospects in their system for catcher, so they turned him into a pitcher. He makes his professional debut with Bellingham and eventually works his way up and starts really finding his groove. In 1977, has a breakout season in Clinton, Iowa with the Clinton Dodgers, goes 17-4, a 2.15 earned run average, 15 complete games, 3 shutouts. However, fails to win the Midwest League MVP and top prospect honors to whom? Some kid with the Burlington Bees named Paul Molitor. Of course, both those guys would later be teammates with the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, Stewart would make his major league debut in September of 1978 as the Dodgers were playing the San Diego Padres. He allowed just one hit, no runs, struck out one batter. That was his only appearance for the Dodgers that season, and 79 and 80. They wanted him to hone his craft in Albuquerque. Of course, the Dodgers had some pretty good pitchers in the rotation at the time, so there was no need to rush him up there. Well, in 1981, coming out of spring training, the Dodgers were in a conundrum. They were going to cut Stewart because he was out of options and, again, was kind of getting squeezed out of the rotation. Well, they thought better of it, and they decide to cut Don Stanhouse instead. Well, that worked out rather well for both Stewart and the Dodgers, as he would pitch in relief throughout much of that season, appearing in 32 games. He had six saves and a 2.49 earned run average. Got knocked around a little bit in the playoffs. However, the Dodgers would prevail. And as a rookie, Dave Stewart was a World Series champion, as the Yankees would fall to the Dodgers in six games. Now, his time with the Dodgers didn't exactly work out real well. In fact, he was always kind of that number five, number six guy in the rotation, and also had a chip on his shoulder for many reasons. And I'm sure a lot of it could stem back to the days of his father saying you can't make a living as a baseball player when his son was proving him wrong. Now, the Dodgers were going to try to trade Stewart to the Texas Rangers for catcher Jim Sundberg. However, Sundberg didn't waive his no-trade clause. The deal falls apart. So here's Dave Stewart just kind of, lingering around a little bit and not exactly winning the hearts and minds of Dodger management. And in fact, Stewart was part of a play that Tommy Lasorda called the craziest play he'd ever seen, where three runs scored on a wild pitch. It was about time that the Dodgers tried to move Stewart, and they did finally get him over to Texas in a deal for Rick Honeycutt, but that wouldn't happen until August of 1983. Now, it was a controversial move at the time because the Rangers didn't really get the best of Dave Stewart. He had a chip on his shoulder, and he would also get in trouble. In fact, rather unfortunately, Stewart was arrested, not in 1983. This was much later in his career, 1985, I believe. Yeah. In 85, he was arrested on suspicion of lewd contact with a prostitute, later revealed to be a transvestite. Well, that's a bit awkward. After pleading no contest to the lesser charge of soliciting a prostitute, he was fined, had to serve probation, and was given a suspended sentence. Ironically, 2 days after the arrest, the Dallas-Fort Worth Sports Writers awarded Stewart with the Good Guys Award. Well, yeah, he was a good guy for not going ballistic on the transvestite prostitute, I suppose. His time on the field with the Rangers, however, also not so glorious. In fact, 1984 going 7-14, 1985 also not dealing well, not only with transvestite prostitutes, but also the Boo Birds in Texas mercifully giving him the raspberry in a game against Kansas City. And after the game, Stewart called the fans idiots and challenged them to come down on the field and do his job for him, much to the chagrin of Rangers management, who eventually fined him and found a way to just ditch him at the end of the 1985 season. He almost went on to play for Japan, however, signed a contract with the Philadelphia Phillies. His nightmare continued there as he had a 6.00 earned run average over the 85 and 86 seasons. And after 1980, or going into the 86 season, I should say, almost had his career end. The Phillies releasing him May 9th, 1986. He's trying to get his life together. He's trying to get his career together, find that success he had with the Dodgers from several years before. And he can't get a job anywhere. He can't get on the Baltimore Orioles pitching staff. In fact, he had a tryout with them, but they couldn't even find him anywhere in the minor leagues. So eventually he signs a free agent contract with the A's and does a little time in AAA, comes up, has a rocky start in 86, finally finds his groove, finds his forkball too, which would be a major weapon in his arsenal for later on. Goes 9-5 with 3.74 earned run average with 17 starts with Oakland. Now, he would sign a 2-year, $500,000 contract prior to the 1987 season, and it would turn out to be the most valuable bargain contract in the major leagues at that time. He wins 20 games in 1987, strikes out 205 batters. In 88, he goes 21-12, has a 3.23 earned run average, and becomes the anchor of the A's rotation as that team would become a powerhouse. Now, Bob Welch would also be a key figure in that rotation, but Dave Stewart, career and personal life revived, becomes a key cog in an Oakland team that was best known for the Bash brothers of McGuire and Canseco. But without the pitching of guys like Welch and Dave Stewart, the A's would not have appeared in three consecutive World Series and won the World Series in 1989. So in 89, he goes 21-9. Finishes second in the voting for the American League Cy Young Award, believe it or not. Finishes second to Brett Saberhagen. And in 1989, like I said, won the World Series, goes on to 1990, 22-11. But it was well worth it as he signed a 2-year, $7 million contract extension going into the 1990 season. It was the largest contract in baseball at the time, soon to be outdone by teammate Jose Canseco. But like I said, it was worth every penny, going 22-11. Actually finished third in the Cy Young voting that year, and also threw a no-hitter on that day. That was the same day that the Dodgers' Fernando Valenzuela no-hit the Cardinals. When was that? June 29th. That's right. June 29th, 1990, he no-hit the Toronto Blue Jays, and it would be the first time in Major League history two no-hitters had been thrown in both leagues on the same day. Now, after the 1990 season, he is cruising along in 1991, but suffers a rib injury, goes 11-11. 1992, slightly better, goes 12-10. But the A's are starting to slip. The Blue Jays are starting to rise. And as a free agent in the winter of 1992, Stewart signs with the Blue Jays for $8.5 million and trashes GM Sandy Alderson on the way out and says he was disrespected. Well, he goes on to win a World Series in 1993. In fact, he was the starting pitcher for the Jays in Game 6 of that series, which Joe Carter would win with that walk-off three-run home run. His numbers slip a bit in 1994, and he was really upset about the player strike that cut short that season. Tried to bounce back in 1995 with the A's, but had a disastrous 3-7 record and 6.89 earned run average in 16 starts. He was supposed to be moved to the bullpen in favor of hobby legend Todd Van Poppel, but Stewart said, no thanks, and he basically walked after that. Now, ironically, he would join Alderson's front office in Oakland and eventually work his way up, first through coaching and then later with management, and he would later become the general manager of the Arizona Diamondbacks. As I mentioned, Darnell Coles, the hitting coach, now with the Diamondbacks, but Stewart was there starting in September of 2014, and he signed Zach Greinke to that monstrous $206.5 million deal, which has recently been dumped on the Houston Astros, although the Astros will gladly take Greinke in their playoff run here. So Dave Stewart, a remarkable story. You know, think about it, a guy who had a lot of, first of all, his dad didn't believe that he could be a professional athlete. Then his brother kind of coaches him up. He turns down all these football scholarships, becomes a prospect in the Dodgers system, has a tough time breaking into the rotation, bounces around in Texas and Philadelphia, can't get a minor league deal anywhere else, takes a flyer with the A's, and thanks a lot in part to Dave Duncan, the pitching coach there, was able to revive his career and have one hell of a career too, be a Cy Young candidate, a World Series champion again in 1989. And over the course of his career, win 168 games and strike out 1,741 batters. And finally, pulled the all-star card for Tom Hankey, the Terminator. You know, it's been a while since I've talked about a Blue Jay, so I have to do this. First of all, Tom Hankey, of course, with his big, fat glasses. I mean, I had the same type of glasses when I was a kid. Tom Hankey just looked like a big, fat doofus on every baseball card. But this guy was fierce. It's 6 foot five with a wicked fork ball. That was his out pitch. And he could throw some heat too, but again, at 6 foot five, he was pretty dominating, just imposing as a physical specimen. He wasn't very muscular, but he was just lanky, 6 foot five, mean guy who could throw some gas. And again, that forkball could just kill you, just eat you up inside. And Tom Hankey was born in Kansas City. Unlike Dave Stewart, had a very active father who would catch his pitches when he was very young. He was drafted by the Seattle Mariners in 1979, but did not sign. Later in 1980, drafted by the Cubs, but did not sign. He would eventually, in a secondary draft, get picked up in the fourth round by the Texas Rangers. So, in fact, he was he briefly? No, he wasn't a teammate with Stewart. Close, though, in Texas. They would be teammates in Toronto later. But, or actually, no, they wouldn't. They missed the crossing paths again. I'll get to that in a moment. Anyways, Hankey very quickly moves up through the Blue Jays organization, or through the Rangers organization, I should say. Makes his major league debut in 1983. Had a little bit of control issues early on in his career, and had a little trouble finding his spot in the Rangers bullpen. Well, the Blue Jays would pick him up from the Rangers as a free agent compensation pick, he said carefully. So he very quickly moves up through the Blue Jays organization then and gets promoted to Toronto during the Blue Jays 85 pennant drive. And he would pretty much lock down the closer's role for the Blue Jays for many, many years. Now, Hankey was not on the mound when the Blue Jays won the World Series in 92. At least he wasn't the pitcher credited with the save. It was actually Mike Timlin who finished up Game 6 against the Atlanta Braves. However, he would be the champion with the Blue Jays in 1992 and then signed as a free agent in 1993. So again, just narrowly missing paths with Dave Stewart here, as Stewart's coming in as a free agent starter. Hankey goes to Texas to become a free agent closer. Had a career-high 40 saves in 1993. Had a so-so year in 1994. Had a lot of injuries. But then at the age of 37, signs with the Cardinals in 1995. Has 22 saves in 1995. Had the first 22 saves. Had a total of 36 saves in the season. And decided to retire while he was on top. And he certainly did that with a record of 642 games pitched, 2.67 earned run average, 311 saves. You know, the old benchmark for Hall of Fame for a relief pitcher, for a closer, was 300 saves. Now, of course, that number's been shattered by Trevor Hoffman and Mariano Rivera and many, many others over the years. Still, the old benchmark was 300 saves, and to think that Hankey eclipsed that benchmark, it's easy to forget how dominant he was. Even though Hankey had this kind of doofus look to him with the big glasses and, you know, his lanky body, he was very dominant for a stretch of several years in his career, and he was nicknamed the Terminator. Now, the story goes that John Cerutti, the late John Cerutti, who was a teammate of Hankey's, during some season while they were on the road, they went to the movies, saw the Terminator, and Cerutti gave Hankey the nickname because of how he terminated with very little compassion. He terminated the opposing batters, and the name stuck. So Tom Hankey, the least likely of people when you look at them that you would call the Terminator, but terminate he certainly did. He was a very solid closer for many, many years. Now, he was also a little bit of a folk hero in Toronto. The Blue Jays never really had an established closer in the first 7 or 8 years of their existence. So when Hankey came up in the 85 season, and of course there's pennant fever going on and everyone's backing the Jays, well, there was actually a ballad of Tom Hankey that was written And it utilized the nickname Terminator in it. And thanks to the wonderful invention called the internet, the song is still out there. You can listen to it. And I pulled just a little clip of it. So here's what we call the hook of the Ballad of Tom Henke.
Terminator, Terminator, Terminator. You can bring him in now, but it's even better later. Terminator. Well, he went to play those damn Yankees. They asked, what the hell's this Henke? We all laughed, that's where you blow your nose. Ah, but Henke, he just blew it by him, sent him home and left him crying. And the Blue Jays came out smelling like a rose. 2, 4, 6, 8. Come on, Henke, terminate.
Wow, isn't that something? That sounds like something you play off the Waffle House jukebox at 3 in the morning. The the Ballad of Tom Henke, folk hero, despite the fact that he looks like a nuclear physicist as opposed to a 300-plus save pitcher in Major League history. By the way, Henke is back in Missouri now, living in rural Missouri, very active in Special Olympics, raising funds for Down syndrome. One of his children has Down syndrome, and it's great to see that he is still very active in his community and giving back in many charitable ways. So there you go. Look at just four of the, how many did we have? 56 cards that came out of the 288 top cello packs that we pulled. And some very interesting stories and a lot of career paths. You know, think, you know, it's not quite 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon here, but, you know, you started with Tracy Jones, who was traded for Darnell Coles, and Darnell Coles is now the hitting coach of the Diamondbacks, formerly managed, GM'd by Dave Stewart, who was narrowly twice a teammate with Tom Henke. He left Texas before Henke got up, and then he left Toronto before he went to Toronto before Henke went there. So it's kind of a strange way that things come around here. And if I'm sure if I really wanted to do my homework, I could find some connection from Tom Henke to Tracy Jones just to close the circuit there. But I'm not going to. We're out of time. I've been talking far too long. So again, 88 tops, the girl that wasn't quite so popular in school and kind of was on her own, and most people shunned her, not because of anything she did or didn't do, but because there was something much, much sexier, much flashier over at the other end of the classroom. But all these years later, you come to appreciate 88 Tops. It is actually a much better set than I remembered it. It is a much better set than advertised. And again, because there's so much of it out there, and because it's still largely, I don't want to say unpopular, but just kind of looked over, it's an easy one to put together. If you're looking for a bargain bin beauty, it doesn't get much better than a $5 cello box of 88 Tops at your local card show / flea market, which I will be visiting again this weekend, and I'm looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to joining you again 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, August the 30th. We'll drop that podcast at noon Eastern. Look for a video link the day before for whatever product we're talking about. I haven't decided yet, but we'll figure it out. I'm pretty confident that we will. And if you would like to help us figure it out, make that cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. If all of our listeners donated even just $5 each, that would not only help keep the show running, but help us get some more very interesting cards. I love the bargain bin beauties, but you know, we can dive a little deeper, get into some more extravagant stuff here and there with your support. So I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you for joining me to talk about 88 Tops and long lost what if girlfriends from high school, as well as what if you just walked out of Renato Galasso's baseball card shop in 1984 and saw Doc Gooden and Hank Aaron just hanging around the street corner. How strange would that be? It's been a strange show. Now it's time for me to shut up. I'm Matt Salmon, and I'm your host of Wax Ecstatic. Thanks again for joining me, and we will see you in 2 weeks.